Father Bob Maguire is one of Melbourne's, if not one of Australia's, best-known religious figures. First through his years as a parish priest in South Melbourne, and latterly as a something of a media celebrity on Sunday nights with John Safran. On Triple J, not here, of course. Father Bob's priestly vocation is now being celebrated in film. In Bob We Trust, a story about endings as much as beginnings. Bob Maguire, it could also be something of an introduction to canonisation. Could we call it St. Bob of the Benighted?
You mean fired out of a cannon? Hey, come on.
How do you feel about it?
Oh, good. I enjoy. Thank God she didn't just put out a documentary that was... I told her, I said, don't do it, don't do it. It'll be boring. But you see, Lynn Marie Milburn, I didn't realise, of Ghost Pictures... is in fact an artist, and then out comes the film, and it's a work of art.
It's
not because I'm in it, because she's added bits that are, more suggestive, so to speak.
The film actually concentrates, it uses as its lever, if you like, the story of how you had to fight the church over your eventual retirement. We're now a couple of years on from your point of view. How's it working out now? Do you think you've passed through that, or does some of it still hang with you?
I only picked up recently a saying from a book about a girl who'd been hit by a truck, and her rehabilitation took years. But one of the wise words in it was, the past can be either a burden or an asset. And I think I've gradually emerged from when the past was a burden, which it has been, because I took it as being a dishonourable discharge. I took it. And then it's emerged into being an asset, because I realise now that if you can get through that kind of thing, there's no reason why you can't get into the into some new things. So that's what we're doing. And all I had left after the parish was my foundation. Thank God I had it, because it was like packing your bag, your Gladstone bag, and putting the bits and pieces in. And the main piece, of course, was the Father Bob Maguire Foundation, which has seen me through the next 18 months from dismissal up until the present minute.
You use the word dismissal. The church would use the word retirement.
Oh, yes, but retirement. I mean, retirement, it's a euphemism for, in my case, for, I would have said that the main grievance that they had was that they didn't like my style. They don't mind me, but they don't like the style. And all I was doing was being faithful to the style that I had been commissioned into with Vatican II back in the, whatever it was, 50s, 60s.
I want to get into that in a few minutes' time. Yeah. But first, let me ask you one other question. Did that experience, traumatic as it was and revealed in the film as something of a trauma, have any effect on your faith? Did it shake your faith?
I don't think
did it
so.
Reshape your faith in any way?
See, strangely enough, the title of the film, which is pretentious.
In Bob We Trust.
Yeah, somebody said to me, a colleague, in fact, the other day, I said, go and see the film and tell me what you think of it. He said, what's it called? I said, it's called In Bob We Trust. He said, what about In God We Trust? As though he was having a go. And it didn't take me aback, because I think the origins of the title were when everybody else allegedly lost their respect for me and the cause that was being preached from that St. Peter's and Paul's Church. I thought, well, geez, if they've lost trust in you, you better make up your mind whether, in fact, you are trustworthy, even to yourself. So I then went and had a couple of magnetic signs made within Bob We Trust. It's almost a brazen statement, which I put on my car, if I remember. And I drove around the place more or less brazenly, I would say. I didn't mean it to be pretentious, but it was brazen, as if, well, look, when you hear on the news about what's happened, whatever the residue is going to be, at least I'm going to continue to trust in my, better instinct.
No bitterness there?
I almost avoided bitterness, I would think. I remember a nun telling me once, one of the faithful companions of Jesus, as they're called, she said, Bob, try not to be churlish. Now, isn't that a strong word? Churlish. And I knew what she meant, because you could easily turn into a bishop basher. Or I can't turn into a Catholicism basher because in fact I'm a card-carrying member and a proud card-carrying member of Catholicism. But I don't think that it's necessarily disrespectful to say to the overseer, the bishop, that in fact, with respect, sir, you're going the wrong way, because we're in the middle of something, sir, and you mightn't understand what we're in the middle of, but I'm saying to you, please do not interfere at this juncture, because there's going to be collateral damage and it's going to involve innocent human beings. And they were the persons that we were dealing with, who were, what, the local unloved and unlovely, who had become dependent on us, you see, for a bit of love, I suppose.
I had one of my mates say that the only way to deal with the church, and he's been in another denomination, not a Catholic, for many years, was to actually keep one foot anchored firmly in a parish or in a local community.
Yes.
If you're going to be of any good in the upper reaches of the institution, if you divorce yourself from the grassroots, you become a prisoner of the system.
Oh, indeed. I think you've got to keep your head in the air but your feet on the ground. That parish, that place where I was, had history. It was 1854, which in fact I think they said mass out the front in a paddock, in a tent. And it was at the same time that Eureka was on up in Ballarat, the Eureka Stockade. So to me, a place with history was a great blessing. It was also working class. I hung three flags out the front of the double-storied presbytery eventually, once again to make an enigmatic statement. One of the flags was, of course, Aboriginal and should have been Torres Strait Islander as well, to pay respects to the ancestors, the original owners. The second flag was the Irish, because I wanted to pay respects to the original settlers. And the other flag was the Southern Cross, because I wanted to pay respect to the fact that South Melbourne had been, and Port Melbourne, had been working class waterfront suburbs.
This is ownership of the history of a culture. And
yes.
Again, it's something that some who are steeped in ecclesial history may find difficult. That is, the question is where you put your roots. And you are saying you essentially you've got to be anchored and attached into that community.
Oh, I would believe so. The word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. You know, I mean, you do bread and wine in the church building on Sundays, but you have to do bread and wine in the streets and the lanes and the houses of your locality. It's down the road was another place called West St Kilda, where they started a thing called the Sacred Heart Mission, and they did very well. And I used to be a bit jealous of them, because they had a parish who had found a mission. And I used to say, during my time in South Melbourne, we are a parish looking for a mission. West St Kilda fell straight into it, because they were in the red light area, prostitutes on the steps of the church, a constant stream of people around the red light area, Sacred Heart Church slap bang in the middle. Before long, they became known as the heart of the neighbourhood.
It's a question that bedevils a lot of people who struggle with this, is about whether the church is about, essentially about this world or about the next.
Oh, well, I think, you see, it should be about the mysterious mix of this world and the next. I think we're entitled to a taste of the next world, of the other world, I'm saying. Jesus said, what the kingdom of heaven is now. Well, that's what I believe. And, you know, here and now, whereas an institution says, no, you're just being mischievous. I'm in charge of the institution. I'm telling you that you're 75 and you should get out and go and smell the roses and knit scarves or do something like that. And I'm saying, well, excuse me, sir, but I believe that we're actually got our hands into this paddock, and the locals, as in West St Kilda, the locals are actually looking at us as being the heart of the neighbourhood. And mind you, that's not just the working class, John. The working class got used to the idea, or the underclass, sorry, got used to the idea that this was, that patch was theirs, the 0.9 of an acre was theirs. But also I wanted to appeal to the other class that had moved back in after they'd vacated it during the Depression, I think. They moved back in, and that's what I call the aspirational class.
Yes, it was an interesting mix of the gentrified.
Oh, well, there you are.
I
would say that was Catholic.
Yes.
And in fact, I was determined not to let the place become solely for the poor, at least for the material poor. But we had the opportunity, because we opened a thing called the South Melbourne Commons in an empty school building, which meant the aspirationals could come up and they could drink their cafes lattes in their own cafe, and they could have their vegan meals, and they could take part in things like planting organic vegetables and doing all the things the aspirationals love to do. And at the same time, the underclass could come up and do the things that they like to do, which is to eat without paying, which is to use the church building, beautiful building, if misfortune struck them and one of theirs died prematurely, which they do, of course, because we buried 40 in the 80s. And I was reminded of that yesterday listening to Paul Keating's speech about the unknown soldier, when he said, well, by the way, don't forget the unknown soldier is one of them, but he's also all of us. And that's what I've been distressed about, that the 40 who died in the 80s, and we've got a plaque in the garden of the church, I'm looking at them this morning and I'm saying, well, those guys and girls, they were them, but at the same time, they're us. And I think that was the main reason why I was distressed to leave, because it was like leaving a sacred site. I said to somebody, look, if I told the Archbishop that Our Lady of Emerald Hill had appeared to me in the garden and she told me, don't go, how would he handle that?
Bob, you should have done it.
Well, I thought it. I thought about it later and I thought, well, I'll use the other thing, that the 40 who died in the 80s, surely, are a spiritual / religion reason why you should stand by the empty grave. And it wasn't good enough, because they were determined that I was an embarrassment, and that was the end of that. But anyway, I took that ethos down the street, not far. But, you miss the patch. You miss the beautiful church where you can, every morning you can go in, unlock the door, you can turn to the east and you can see the sun rising and shining through that glorious stained glass window. And every night you could go into the church to lock it and you're looking west and you can see the glorious setting sun behind the rose window. So you miss out on that sustenance. You've got to feed yourself once you're off outside the patch.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guest is Father Bob Maguire. Recently the subject of a movie, In Bob We Trust, on current release. Bob Maguire, you've given us some sense of the parish and the people you worked with, and some sense of your difficulty with the formal structures of the church. Where does Jesus fit in this? Who and what is this Jesus that you've given your life to?
Oh, I presume it's that's the driving force, the X factor, the unknown God, as Paul of Tarsus declared him to be on when he visited the temple in Athens, full of statues and niches with statues, and there's an empty pedestal. And he said, who's that? You've got every other god here. They said, well, that's the unknown god. And he said, well, that's the one I'm working for. And I think that Jesus of Nazareth is, in fact, the unknown factor.
What are you doing when you stand up and celebrate Mass, when you raise the host? What's going on there?
Well, you do what he said to do. There's no more blood.
Yeah, but is that an empty ritual, or what's the meaning for you?
No.
There's got to be some transcendent meaning in there for you, isn't there?
You get together,
yeah,
which is important sacramentally. Wherever two or three get together, there I am. You do that. You gather the folks. You tell the story. You break the bread. And then you commit yourself and the collective to leave the ritual and to go and become activists. That's all in it. That's what I'm saying. If you don't commit yourself to become activists, well, then, in fact, the ritual is empty.
And by activists, what do you mean?
I mean putting others first. That's the whole thing. You've got to put yourself in. If it's good enough for God, so to speak, to put himself, herself, themselves in.
Into the world.
Yeah. Imagine if you were all-powerful, all-knowing, ever-living and whatever it is, prepared to put yourself into a vulnerable position with humanity that you'd created. I mean, that's a great act of sacrifice, isn't it? That's what all the heroic figures do. Superman and Spider-Man and all of those. You see, the fascinating thing about our hero figures that we create is that they're vulnerable. Now, here we've got a God. This is what worries me about the atheists who bang on about a God that's much smaller than the God that I believe in. Much smaller. It's no wonder that they reject the God thing, because they've got a God made in their own image and likeness. It's too small.
Bob, it's not hard, listening to you speak, to understand why some in the church, particularly those concerned with clerical institutions and structures, would find what you're saying beyond the pale.
But
in some ways, given what's happened over the last 30 years, and you look at the theologians who've fallen foul of Rome and others, it could be surprising to some that you survived as long as you did.
Well, they know I'm right. You see, even my archbishop says, no, Bob's a marvellous, faithful priest. It's just that the way he does things is not acceptable.
Let me ask you a question. Where does theology fit in this for you, the structures of belief? Like, what do you believe about the nature of Jesus?
Well, I can stand up and say I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. But, I mean, I'm saying I can say that, but, I mean, my real belief has got to be what? As Jesus said, show me your faith and I'll show you my good works. You see? Don't tell me that your faith is more powerful than my good works, because that's the way that I show my faith. I do good things. Now, to me, you know, I mean, theology is a construct. It's been welded. Thank God we had the theologians right through the first, 1,000 years? And they put everything in formulas, because that was the Roman way and the philosophical way. So we had neatness and tidiness. But you see, what we missed out on was imagination. And you need imagination. You need to express. They're only statements.
In some senses, theology is metaphor.
Indeed. You see, that's what we've got to get to the metaphor. I'm reading a book now by a bloke called, what's his name? His surname is Aslan.
Reza Aslan.
Yeah, it's called The Zealot. And I was reading through it and I said, oh, my God, it sounds like my friend Michael Morwood, who also wrote a book and was showing the distinction, as far as he was concerned, between Jesus the Christ and Jesus of Nazareth. And here's Aslan banging on in the same. I'm thinking, hello, here it is again. The difference between Jesus of Nazareth, the personality, and Jesus the Christ, who is the, they would say, the construct. The theologians constructed the Christ, and the personality almost is squeezed out.
Do you think there's some truth in that?
I think there's some truth in that, certainly. I think what the world needs now is more of Jesus of Nazareth than it does of Jesus the Christ, because the Christ is depersonalizes Jesus, and what we need now is more personality.
What do you think of those last 3 days? What's the meaning of the death and resurrection? Do you literalize it? Do you spiritualize it? What do you do?
I'm not arguing about the resurrection of Jesus, because the fact of the matter is that he lives. I know that my Redeemer liveth. But you're going to want to, somebody wants to argue with me about, yes, well, exactly what does that mean? And I'm saying, look, I'm not particularly interested in defining it. I'm more interested in describing it. You know what I mean? If Jesus is risen from the dead, I can describe that because I've met Jesus risen from the dead every day of every week, of every month, of every year since I was conceived and born. I can describe Jesus risen from the dead. Now somebody says, that's not good enough, you've got to define it. And I'm saying, no, that's the mistake we're making. We're actually trying to define, and we're then finding that we can't live off that. You see, like the autistic child who was kneeling beside his bread, his brother's listening outside the door, and he hears his autistic brother saying something like, hello, Jesus, I know that you live under my bed, and I'd like you to... And the brother outside the door said, what the... Is he talking about Jesus lives under his bed? And I'm saying, well, hello, I resonate with the autistic boy who feels that closeness. Now, what would I do if somebody said, well, you can't have that closeness, you've got to be prepared to make the statement, I believe in Jesus, crucified, dead and buried. Well, I'm sorry, I prefer the relationship than to be able to recite the formula. You know what I mean? Now, if you can have both. See, I believe you can have both.
What you're saying seems to resonate these days, particularly with the arrival of Pope Francis.
Yeah.
He's putting an emphasis on this being there and experiencing and
yeah, because
and
he's
the
met
doing.
Jesus over his years in Argentina. He admits that he probably, wasn't as close to Jesus of Nazareth. He was closer to Jesus the Christ in his first, I don't know how many years, when he was the provincial of the Jesuits, and then when he was an assistant bishop. He would admit to that. He then has grown into the Francis who is closer to the Jesus of Nazareth and wary of the Jesus created by the institution.
Something of an irony then that your forced departure from the scene is accompanied by the arrival of somebody who you think more reflects your understanding, at least to the extent that you understand Francis, your understanding of the church?
Indeed. I mean, one is grateful because one went to the top of the mountain and saw the promised land in the 50s. We saw the promised land and people for the next 30 years tried to tell us, no, you hadn't. You didn't go to the top of the mountain seeing the promised land. You saw a mirage. And we've been hanging on for 20, 30 years. And lo and behold, you know, an epiphany. You've got the chief bishop who calls himself the Bishop of Rome rather than the Pope. He calls himself the Bishop of Rome. Comes out and says, well, guess what, folks? What? Jesus lives under my bed. And he believes it. He believes in the proximity, the closeness. He's also, thank God, he's not a rabble-rouser because, in fact, he's a devotional Catholic and also Latin American, highly devotional. So he's not all activist. He's activist tempered by devotion and he's devotional tempered by action. Now, that's an unbelievably faithful presentation of Catholicism.
Do you think over the years, given the robustness of the life you've led as a parish priest, you can understand why you've rubbed some people up the wrong way?
Yeah, but it never happened, John. It never happened early. See, the strange thing to me, and that's what gave me confidence to get through the last two or three years, was that we were the flavour of the month for the first 30 years. Now, something happened. We didn't change, but the administration of the diocese changed. I mean, even George Pell, God love him. It's only when he left Now, I'm not saying anything other than that. All I'm saying is it's a coincidence.
But do you think the reason that you irked people towards the end, so that they said, look, we're going to make this retirement a definite one, had to do with theology, that is, what you were believing and saying seemed to be out of step with the message coming out of Rome, or ecclesiology, that is, you weren't willing to toe the line bureaucratically?
Oh, I think so, and even ecclesiology, I don't know whether I'd classify it even as ecclesiology, because ecclesiology would be more or less talking about the church as a movement. Whereas administratively, you see...
That's it. Were they irked by your theological deviance or your administrative refusal to toe the line?
No, they know. They know. They know that I'm orthodox, but I'm unconventional. You see? None of them would say I was unorthodox.
So you believe it came down to simple administration, administrative.
And that's, as an old digger, that's where I salute and leave the parade ground. You have to.
Bob McGuire, we're rapidly running out of time.
Yes.
Let's come back to the film finally. In watching the film, it's set up, the wonderful framing of the film in the context of Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal, which is a debate over the nature of the soul and what entitles one to claim your soul.
Yes.
And that's sort of deep theology on one side. On another hand, as I'm watching it, I'm reminded of another film, which isn't referenced, and that is, of course, Monty Python's The Life of Brian.
Oh, dear.
Because there's a sense in which there's a commentary going on throughout The Life of Brian, as there is in your film.
We must thank the Romans for the aqueducts, and we must thank the Romans for the roads and all of that kind of... We must thank the Romans, you know. I mean, the Romans were a remarkable imperial institution, and so has the church been.
But there's something Python-esque about your debate with the church, too. And I think you are deliberately dragging a little bit of that into your discourse, into your discussion.
Oh, yes, I think I've accepted that rather than be churlish and bitter and all that kind of stuff, that one could be, what's the word, one could be humorously truthful.
There is also an element in your style of the always look on the bright side of life.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was reminded of that, of how useful the music from Monty Python, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, how useful it was pastorally, because I was presiding over a funeral in a public space. But I don't want the church police starting to think that I was doing it in church. And the father of the deceased, a young man who was killed in a car accident, had arranged in the public space to have a screen facing the congregation, the audience, and on that screen at the end, they put up a scene from Monty Python, and we carried the coffin out of the space to the sound of Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. The crowd loved it.
Bob McGuire, an appropriate place to wind up this little insight into your adventurous life. Bob McGuire, Father Bob, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night, and you can still be heard regularly with John Safran.
And don't forget to go to the pictures, for God's sake. Please go to the pictures.
Bob McGuire on Sunday night.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on! Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep 'em laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always.